Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Jimmy Akins, our guest this hour, and it's open forum. So your calls are very, very welcome. Whatever question you've got, you are welcome here. And please be certain that whether you're Catholic or not, your question is welcome here. Lots and lots of folks have a question or maybe something they've heard about the Catholic faith. They want to test that out or see if that's true or see what it means. And if that's the case with you, you are welcome here. 888-318-7884. Jimmy, as I said just before we went to the break, is the senior apologist here at Catholic Answers. As a matter of fact, coming up on a big anniversary in June. June 1st. The Feast
of St. Justin Martyr.
The very well-named St. Justin Martyr. 30 years of doing... So that means you were here before the radio show by 5 years. You were...
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And did you...
I remember the meetings where we were talking about having a radio show and discussing what it might involve and what it might be like.
Well, you all did good because it lasted 25 years. You came up with something good. You came up with a good formula. And you were on the first day.
Yes, the show. I was.
Yeah, you were on. But now, in the early days, you all did an hour, right? You didn't. It took a while before you
expanded
to 2 hours. Yeah.
Correct.
All right, let me see how many. We got a bunch of folks on the line, a whole bunch of calls. So we will go to the phones. If you'd like to call, 888-318-7884 is the number. Andrew in Miami is first this hour. Listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Andrew, go ahead with your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hello, gentlemen. Happy Tuesday.
Well, happy Tuesday. And happy Feast of St. Nicholas, Andrew.
Amen. so I'm having difficulty reconciling two passages, technically three. Mm-hmm. In 1 Chronicles 21, 1, it says, then Satan stood against Israel and incited David to number Israel, to take a census. And then that was considered the same, and then God punished David.
Andrew, I'm having trouble hearing you. Can you speak directly into the phone, please? And if you've got us on speakerphone, take us off.
Can you hear me now?
That got even farther away, Andrew. And there's, it's like, I don't
oh,
know.
Boy.
Oh, no. Okay. Give it a try. Right into the phone, Andrew. Give it a shot.
Okay. How about now?
Better.
How about?
Better.
Okay. Okay, good. Good. I want to know. Okay. All right. Let me see. Oh, yeah. And then 2 Samuel 24, 1. 2 Samuel chapter 24, verse 1, it said, the Lord moved David to take a census. So it's two renderings, but one said that Satan did it, the devil, and then the other says that God did it. They both incited David to take a census. So is that a contradiction? And if it is, does that conflict with the Catholic doctrine of infallibility?
Okay, you said there was a third passage. What's the third passage?
James chapter 1, which says that God is not the author of evil. So if God incited David to do the census, is he the author of evil?
Okay. So there's more than one way of approaching this. Now, in light of the fact that God does not cause people to do evil— as James says, we have to read any Old Testament text that, or any other text that attributes the causation of evil to God, meaning moral evil, as really just indicating what God allowed. One of the ways that the ancient Israelites would communicate the greatness of God was by attributing everything to God and just saying, God did it. And it's true that God at least allowed it to happen as part of his plan, but it wasn't literally true that God did everything. He didn't cause people to do evil. And so that's the first thing to recognize. So that takes care of the James passage. God is not the author of evil. So whatever these passages mean, at most they would mean God allowed this to happen. So what about the difference in 1 Samuel and 1 Chronicles about who incited, or 2 Samuel and 1 Chronicles, about who incited David to take the census? Was it God or was it Satan? Well, it could be both. It could be that, in a kind of clunky way, they could both have a causation here, or more intelligibly, in light of the fact that God is not the author of evil, it could be that God allowed Satan to stir up David to take the census. And in that case, 2 Samuel is expressing the fact that God allowed this in his providence by saying God did it. And the author of First Chronicles, the chronicler as he's called, is being more precise about precisely who did it. Under God's plan, it was Satan who did this. But there is another alternative, which is that it's not that First Chronicles is not actually referring to Satan. Now, if you look in a standard English Bible, it's going to say Satan with a capital S, but they don't have capital letters or they don't have the distinction between capital letters and lowercase letters in Paleo Hebrew script, which is the kind of writing that was used at the time. Everything was the same case. And so they didn't use capital letters to mark proper names. And Satan, or in Hebrew, Satan, is not a proper name anyway. It can be translated different ways. It can mean an accuser. It can mean a prosecutor. And it can mean an enemy. And if you stick the definite article, you know, the equivalent of the, which is in Hebrew, ha, if you stick ha on the front of Satan, so it becomes ha Satan, well, that tells you you're talking about one prosecutor, adversary, enemy, or accuser in particular, and later that prosecutor, attorney, opposer became identified with the Christian devil. And so that's why we today refer, on the basis of New Testament texts, to refer to the devil as Satan. But originally, this term had other uses. It could refer to any prosecutor or adversary. And in 1 Chronicles 24 or 21:1, if you look in the Hebrew, the definite article is not there. It does not say, "And the Satan did this." Instead, it just says, "And Satan did this." And in Hebrew, they don't have an equivalent of the word "ah." They don't have an indefinite article like we do. So in English, if I just mean some, like if I'm talking about some fish, I could say a fish. Or if I'm talking about some antelope, I could say an antelope. But in Hebrew, they don't have that. So if you meant just some antelope or some fish, you just have to say antelope or fish, and you wouldn't say the antelope or the fish. Well, that's what's going on here, because the definite article, the, is not in the Hebrew. It does not say ha Satan. It just says Satan. And that means we're not talking about a particular clearly identified enemy or adversary. It just means some adversary stood up against Israel and incited David to number Israel or take a census of Israel. So on that hypothesis, the way to square these two is by saying God is the one who's functioning as an adversary of Israel here. In 2 Samuel, it says that God was angry with Israel, and he incited David against them, saying, "Go count Israel and Judah." And here in First Chronicles, it says an enemy stood up against Israel and urged David to count Israel. So some have proposed, and like I said, this is only a proposal, it's not a certainty, but some have proposed, well, God was angry with Israel. He was acting as their adversary at that point, and at least the way the text depicts it, it would be God stirring up Israel, stirring up David to take the census. And then the way we would explain that in light of our greater knowledge about the fact that God is not the author of evil, we would say, well, God allowed David to be stirred up and take a census. It's not that God literally induced David to commit sin. So there's a little meditation for you on these three passages and how they can be squared.
Thanks, Andrew. It brings us to our first break. We'll take that break. Be right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Your questions, Catholic Answers Live. Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
He is honored by the Church as a saint and the first diocesan priest to be declared a doctor of the Church.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
St. John of Avila was known to his contemporaries as a spiritual master, and he served as a guide to some of the greatest saints of the 1500s. He also called for true reform in the Church and was a role model for the priesthood even today. He died in 1569.
To find out more about the Doctors of the Church, visit EWTN.com and click on Catholicism.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. As you would expect, phone lines have been quite busy with Jimmy Akin here for Open Forum. However, from time to time, as right now, one or two lines is opening up, and you're welcome to use them. 888-318-7884. We're going all the way up to Windham, Maine now. Jacob in Windham, Maine, watching on YouTube. You are next. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi.
Hi, Jacob.
So my question is, I and my friend are both under 18. However, I've done something very gravely bad. So I need to go to confession. But the best way would be if he drove me. However, it is not legal for him to drive with another minor in the car yet. So I was wondering if it would be moral for me to go if we'd have to break that law.
Well, you know, there are other possible ways of getting to church or getting to confession. And ideally, you know, you would want to explore those. But if you've done that and this really is the best way, then no, it would not be immoral to get a ride from your friend. You would want your friend to be really careful because you don't want him to get in trouble for driving with another minor in the car. But if he's otherwise qualified to drive and he's real safe in taking you to go to confession, then it would not be in principle immoral. Civil laws, like, you know, the regulations on driving, are not moral absolutes. They are guidelines for how to regulate society. And under ordinary circumstances, we are morally obliged to obey them. But there are circumstances which the law is not designed to cover, and certainly the laws of the United States are not designed to cover this situation. And there can be a valid reason for ignoring a civil law. You know, a classic example is stealing if you're starving. If you're starving and have no other way to get food, you could steal some food from someone who has food to spare. You know, that would be a legitimate reason for ignoring the civil law in that situation. And so if you've determined that in this situation, the best way for you to go is to go with your friend, even though he's not technically allowed to drive with you in the car yet, you could do that. Another option that you might want to consider is getting an adult to go along with you and your friend and say, hey, we want to go down to church and go to confession or whatever like that. Would you come with us? Now, if there's a reason you can't do that, then that's understandable, but there's an option that you should also consider.
Jacob, thank you very, very much for that question. If you'd like, I'd like to send you a copy of Jimmy's book, The Words of Eternal Life, True Happiness and Where to Find It. If you'd like it, hang on the line and Edgar will send it off to you. And leaving Maine, we go down to Jacksonville, Florida. Brandon in Jacksonville, Florida, watching on YouTube. You are next. Go ahead, Brandon, with your question for Jimmy.
Hello. Thank you very much for having me on. My question was about an Eastern Orthodox person that I was watching said that the liturgical abuse in the Roman Church is one of the key indicators that it's not the true church because it's lost its traditional liturgical heritage. So I was going to ask, how would a Catholic refute that, given that there is a good degree of truth to the statement?
Which statement is there a good degree of truth to in your mind?
The fact that many places the Roman Missal is often abused in many parishes across the United States, it's become somewhat of like a common theme to see that. Of course, Rome has told people they're not supposed to do that, but it inevitably happens a lot. So I was going to say,
yeah.
How would we refute that claim?
Well, I would say there are several things to say here. The first one is the idea that there are more liturgical abuses now than there used to be is highly debatable. Now, there was a period of experimentation that involved a lot of liturgical abuse immediately after the Second Vatican Council. So if you're talking about the 1970s, yeah, okay, things were pretty wild then liturgically. But with the reign of John Paul II, things began to get systematically better. And these days, they are way better than they used to be. So are there liturgical abuses in some parishes today? Sure. But it's not as widespread as people make it sound. And it's way better than it used to be. Furthermore, they had liturgical abuses before the Second Vatican Council. There have always been liturgical abuses because priests are human beings and they get lazy and they want to be creative and they do stuff in liturgy that they shouldn't. And that applies to pre-Vatican II Catholic priests and it applies to Eastern Orthodox priests too. They're not always obeying their liturgical laws. And so this brings us to kind of another point, which is this is entirely a subjective matter. You know, exactly what counts as a liturgical abuse and exactly how widespread liturgical abuses are, it's purely subjective and impressionistic. And that means this ain't a good test for who's the true church, because God does not want you to decide who's the true church on the basis of wildly subjective impressions. And that's all we have here at best. Are there more liturgical abuses in the Catholic Church in a particular time frame than in the Orthodox Church, or is it the reverse? Why should this time frame be picked rather than some other time frame? If you really wanted to say this is a sign of the falsity in the church, it would need to characterize the church's entire history. But it's really hard to say that if you're just appealing to the modern period, you know, following Vatican II. If you said, things were liturgically okay in the church prior to Vatican II and the liturgical reform, well, then why is now relevant to that? The church didn't just suddenly defect from being the true church. Also, who said that that the celebration of the liturgy in a particular way is a sign of whether you're the true church or not? Christ didn't say that. The church fathers didn't say that. Your friend is making it up. And that's ultimately the truth here. Your friend is picking on this because he thinks that the Catholic Church is vulnerable on this front, and he's decided that, oh, here's a vulnerability. I can use this to argue the Catholic Church is not the true church. And so that's the argument he's making, even though there's no rational basis for it. But there have always been liturgical abuses, and that applies not just to the Christian church. It applies to the Jewish religion as well. If you go back into the Old Testament and you look at the beginning of 1 Samuel, the high priest is Eli, and his sons are committing all kinds of liturgical abuses. And later in the history, it gets worse. They start putting pagan idols in the temple in Jerusalem. They start worshiping the bronze serpent so that it has to be destroyed. They started committing all kinds of horrendous liturgical abuses that were way worse than anything you find in the Catholic Church or the Orthodox Church. And yet, the Jewish faith was the true religion at the time. And so that shows us liturgical abuses are simply not a test of who is the true religion, and your friend should take that to heart.
And I will leave that there because, again, the lines are very, very full. But, Brandon, thank you very, very much for that call. Appreciate it. And I'm going to Alex in North Dakota watching on YouTube. Alex, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi. Yeah. So I'm going to be getting a checkup here pretty shortly with my parents' insurance plan. There's nothing wrong with the insurance plan that doesn't support abortion or anything like that. But I'm concerned because in order to use it, I'd have to go to a state clinic. And it's not like Planned Parenthood or anything like that. It's just a generic state clinic. So my question is, would it be okay for me to use that and go there in light of the fact that they may be advising people to get abortions or use contraceptives or stuff like that?
Okay, let me ask you a question. Do you ever order pizza, Alex?
I do occasionally. Not much out here.
Okay. And do you, when you order pizza, are you aware of the fact that the person who you're ordering the pizza from is a sinner?
Yes.
And since they're a sinner, is it reasonable to infer that the person you order the pizza from is going to at some point commit a sin?
Yes.
Okay. Does that mean that you can, the fact that this person you're ordering the pizza from, that they're at some point going to commit a sin, does that mean that you cannot do business with them?
No.
Okay. So we've learned from that just because someone may commit a sin doesn't mean we can't, that we have to refuse to do business with them. So that means that even if a state clinic is doing something it shouldn't with some people, that doesn't stop you from being able to use that service legitimately. And so you don't need to, this is something that St. Paul talks about. We cover it here on the show all the time. You know, he says that he does not expect us in living the Christian life to leave the world. And if we acted on the principle that we can never have anything to do with anybody who's a sinner, we could never have anything to do with anybody, and we would have to leave the world. So as long as you're not doing something wrong, you don't got to get scrupulous about this. So don't be scrupulous about it. Furthermore, you're a minor, so you need to do what your parents tell you. And if they say you need to go get a checkup here at this clinic, then go get a checkup at that clinic.
Thank you very much, Alex, for that call. I'm going to go to we are bouncing up and down and back and forth across the country today. Frank in Boston is next, watching on YouTube. Frank, we're glad you're here. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hi. Well, I work as an artist and illustrator a lot of times. I do a lot of freelance work, and I thought this question would be good for Mr. Akin because, as you probably know, when people do concept art, things like that, they go through tons of resources. And I caught myself the other day just I kind of had like my – I actually stopped in my tracks. I was researching and getting runes and stones and stuff from Mesopotamia. Then all of a sudden I noticed I'm copying and drawing and taking down references from like ancient depictions of deities and demons from that culture. And then I stopped. I'm like, as a Catholic, am I playing with fire is kind of my question. And on a side note, I do struggle with scrupulosity a lot, but I just wanted to hear your thoughts on this.
Okay, I'm going to need more clarity on exactly what it was you were doing, because I'm not. I understand you were doing some image searching and you ran across pictures of runes from Scandinavia and some pictures from Mesopotamia. And I'm not exactly sure what was else was involved here. Was that the extent of it?
Sometimes sometimes I feel like it's benign, like I'm looking at paganism and things like that. I'll look at Druidism from like the Celts and things of that nature. But the other day I'm doing it and I came across like it looked familiar and I couldn't put my finger on it. Then I realized it was that Pazuzu character from that Exorcist movie that I was actually copying and getting ideas from, looking at that.
Okay.
I'm like, wait, they actually have to call an exorcist for this one.
All right, Frank, we'll get an answer to your question right after this, but we got to take this break. Right back with more Open Forum on Catholic Answers Live. The recent decision by the U.S. Supreme Court to overturn Roe v. Wade was a monumental victory for the pro-life movement. But the fight is far from over. With our new booklet, Why We're Pro-Life, we have produced the perfect tool to prepare you to have peaceful and convincing conversations to shed light on the truth about human life from conception to natural death. Catholic Answers is printing millions of copies of this booklet, and we plan simply to give them away. You can help us in two ways. First, by generously supporting this project. 25 cents prints one book. $2,500 prints 10,000, and so on. Second, by helping us distribute the booklet through your parish, your school, or the pro-life ministry you work with. Catholic Answers is going to blanket the country with Why We're Pro-Life, but only if you step up and help us. Thank you so much. For more information, visit whyweareprolife.com.
Want to know more about the origins of the Catholic Church? Joe Heschmeyer explores the beginnings of Christianity. In the early church was the Catholic Church. Joe digs deep into the words and actions of those who lived right after the apostles to refute anti-Catholic claims of how the faith was lived back then. Order your copy of The Early Church Was the Catholic Church today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
As Catholic apologetics have gotten stronger, Protestant responses have gotten stronger as well. And now they have their own answers to rebut the standard Catholic proofs. Don't fret, we've got you covered. In his new book, Meeting the Protestant Response, apologist Carlo Broussard gives well-reasoned biblical answers to Protestant comebacks. Order your copy of Meeting the Protestant Response today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Dr. David Anders here. Where is purgatory in the Bible? Why confess my sins to a priest?
Find out more tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern on Call to Communion.
Now, back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Frank in Boston on the line. Jimmy Akin, our guest this hour, and it's Open Forum. And Frank was asking, because he's an artist who needs to find sources of inspiration for his art, he looks at all kinds of art to find that inspiration, and found himself finding inspiration in a picture from The Exorcist that was a depiction of, I believe it was, of a demon in The Exorcist movie. Jimmy, you were about to give an answer up to this.
So principle number one, do not get your theology from the movie The Exorcist. The Exorcist is a work of fiction. It is not a historically or theologically reliable work. In particular, so the demon in question was Pazuzu, and he's called a demon in English, but that's just what he's called in English. Actually, this is an illustration of how badly The Exorcist mangles the ideas it's working with. Pazuzu is a figure in Mesopotamian mythology, and he's one of the good guys.
No.
He's scary looking, but there's a reason for that. He frightens away the bad guys. Pazuzu was a protector. He frightened away the evil spirits that would cause you bad dreams. And so that's his function one of his functions in Mesopotamian mythology. But here, he gets presented as if he is just one of the bad guys. And okay, you can say, well, he was, you know, I don't like pagan deities or pagan spiritual beings, but you're misrepresenting him. If you're his role in their mythology, it would be like representing Zeus or Apollo as if they were nothing but hardcore evil, when it's like, okay, in Greek mythology, they're not the bad guys, you know. I mean, we shouldn't worship them, and properly speaking, they don't exist, except maybe sometimes some demons impersonate them or something, but they're not like mustache twirling evil beings that want to just cause harm to humanity. So that's just an illustration of how you shouldn't rely on the exorcist for your theology, or your history for that matter. Now, what about the principle? Okay, second thing to say, don't be scrupulous about this. Pagan imagery, unless you have a personal vulnerability, pagan imagery is not going to do you harm. And that's true of anybody, unless they have some kind of personal vulnerability. Looking at a pagan image or an image that was inspired by a pagan image is not going to hurt you. And that's not just my judgment. That's the judgment of the church. And you know how I know that? Go over to Rome. Go to the Vatican museums. Look at what they've got there. You walk in the door, the first thing you see is a pagan statue. It's a statue of Laocoon and his sons being attacked by sea serpents. And you continue, you go through the different galleries in the Vatican museums. They've got pagan statues from Greece and Rome and Egypt and Mesopotamia and all over the place. And this is at the Vatican. So the Vatican is not scrupulous about this. It trusts people to be mature Christians and recognize that just because an image is derived from a pagan source doesn't mean you have to cower in fear and hide your head under a rock. Furthermore, if you go into the Sistine Chapel, which is where they elect the Pope, and you look up on the walls in the Sistine Chapel, you're going to see the Old Testament prophets, and you're going to see the Greek Sibyls. The Sibyls were pagan prophetesses. And this is in the room where they elect the Pope. So they recognize that we can deal with aspects of previous cultures and appreciate beauty and design elements from previous cultures without betraying our faith as Christians. So, Frank, I would say it's good that you have self-awareness, that you can be scrupulous, and I would say do not be scrupulous about this. To the extent a person gives in to scrupulosity, it feeds the scrupulosity and makes it worse, so don't give in to the scrupulosity.
Frank, thank you very, very much for the call. It's open forum. Jimmy Akin, our guest. Still lots of folks to get to. So I'm going to go to Oregon. Allie in Oregon, watching on YouTube. Allie, are you there with us?
Yep, right here.
Hi, Allie. How old are you?
10.
Well, thank you very much for your call. Go ahead with your question for Mr. Akin.
So I was wondering, when we're in heaven, will we see Jesus Christ? Will we only see Jesus Christ, or will we see Jesus Christ and God the Father? And if we do see God the Father, what does he look like?
Well, so we don't have an answer to this from Scripture, and we know that we will see Jesus, and we're, at least Scripture heavily implies that we'll see the Father as well. Now, there's a question about how could we do that since God doesn't have a body apart from the incarnation. But the standard opinion among theologians is that we will see God spiritually with our spiritual eyes rather than with our physical eyes. Now, Jesus has a body, and so we could see Jesus with our physical eyes. It's also possible that God could give us a vision where even though he doesn't have a body, he creates a visual impression of a body and uses that to communicate with us. He does this sometimes in the Bible. He does it, for example, with Daniel. If you look in Daniel, like chapter 7, chapter 9, Daniel sees a vision of God in heaven. He refers to him as the Ancient of Days. And he also then sees one like a son of man, who is Jesus, the son of man, coming before him in heaven. But this was before either Jesus had a body, because it's before Jesus was born, and God the Father has not had a body. And so this is a vision where God creates a visual impression of himself and of Jesus and uses that to communicate with the prophet Daniel. And he can do the same thing with anyone. So God could give us visions. He also can do the same thing with the Holy Spirit. And in terms of what would God look like, well, the way he's commonly depicted, I mean, the answer is he can look like whatever he wants to look like. And we have indication that Jesus may change appearances at times, because we know he looked one way like a normal human being in the Gospels. But if you read the beginning of the book of Revelation, Jesus appears in a different glorious form. And similarly, with God the Father, he's commonly understood to look like a man, often since he's the Ancient of Days, like an older man. But he doesn't really have a body. That's just how he may choose to picture himself or how we might see him. But fundamentally, God can look like however he wants to look.
Allie, I'm curious, what do you think about that? Does that make sense to you?
Yeah.
Well, great. You are very good on the phone. Thanks very much for the call. Maybe we'll get to hear from you again sometime, okay? I'm going to say okay. All right. Thanks, Allie. Let's see. Oh, I'm at the break. Got to take a break. We'll be right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
St. John Paul II stated that, for the disciple of Christ, evangelization is a duty, an obligation of love. And the Catechism of the Catholic Church states that evangelization is necessary for salvation.
So we know we're called, but how do we do it?
St. Paul Street Evangelization can help. To learn more, contact us at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
The most original and exclusive Catholic content is on EWTN Radio.
I don't like looking back. I prefer to look forward and keep moving forward. There's plenty to cover. I do a lot of research and try to dig out the bits and pieces of a life or of an agenda that people don't want to talk about.
The World Over with Raymond Arroyo, Thursday night, 8 Eastern, on EWTN Radio and Television.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host, Jimmy Akin, our guest. And for me, 2 hours, at least the portion we've used up, has flown by, I guess, because it's fun to do open forum with Jimmy Akin. We could probably still get you on. If you got a question, we'll try our best. 888-318-7884 is the number. Can't make a promise, though, because we got some folks in front of you in the line. And we'll go now to Dallas, Texas. Blake in Dallas, Texas, listening on 910 AM. Blake, thank you for your call. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hey, Jimmy. First of all, so happy to speak to you. You've done so much for me throughout my faith journey, so really appreciate that. Hold on, I just realized.
You're very kind. Phones.
Sorry about that. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Yes.
Okay, awesome. Okay, so my question is about Mary.
We were hearing you fine, and then your question was about Mare, and then it just stopped. And I think,
for example, I have one
hey
of
Blake,
best friends.
I don't know what happened
baptized
here. Okay, hang on.
I think his headphones came out.
Something happened, Blake.
Yeah, they did. Sorry. Can
okay,
you hear
so
me?
Yeah, let's just get to right to the question. We can hear you now. So you something about marriage.
Yeah, so valid versus non-valid marriages. I have a friend who is baptized Catholic, but has, you know, was kind of nominally Catholic and left the church and ultimately married a really strong Protestant guy who's also one of my best friends. And so from my understanding, their marriage is not considered valid by the church since she was baptized Catholic, and now, you know, they go to another church, live a very faithful marriage. And so I guess my question is really just, how am I to think about this? Because to me, when I learned that was kind of shocking. Like, should I not celebrate their marriage? I mean, I was his best man at their wedding. I mean, to me, it seems like a beautiful and fruitful and loving marriage, but then the church teaches it's not valid because she was baptized Catholic, even though they're now following, you know,
what year did they get married?
It was like 2 years ago.
Okay. And was she raised Catholic, or was she just baptized Catholic and not raised Catholic?
She was raised Catholic. I think she basically I think she mostly went to Mass growing up. I think basically stopped, you know, probably sometime in college or so.
Mm-hmm. So I would say that I understand your concern here. Now, under the 1983 Code of Canon Law, it had a provision that said if someone defects from the Catholic Church by a formal act, and that could be something like joining another church, then they're no longer bound to observe the Catholic form of marriage. And so, you know, so people in this situation could, you know, have valid marriages. And that situation lasted up until the year 2006. And in 2006, Pope Benedict approved a decree from the Pontifical Council for Legislative Texts that said, we want to institute a process that you have to go through if you want to formally defect. And it seems like that part of the background to this decision was the church tax in Germany. In Germany, they take a portion of your income and give and donate it to whatever church you're a member of. And so you had Germans who were saying, well, I'm no longer a Catholic, so I don't have to pay that tax. And it was incentivizing them to defect from the church. So what the Pontifical Council for Legislative Texts did was say, okay, we're going to institute a process to make sure that someone is really not really sincerely not wanting to be a Catholic anymore, that that it's not just like they're doing this for tax reasons or something else, that they really sincerely do not want to be Catholic anymore. And so they instituted this process that was really cumbersome and that would involve things like meeting with your bishop and convincing him that you really most sincerely don't want to be a Catholic anymore. And then in 2009, Pope Benedict was not happy with the results of that new system, and so he eliminated the concept of formal defection from the church from canon law altogether. So that left us in a situation where if you've ever been a Catholic, if you've ever been baptized or received into the Catholic Church, even if you were never raised Catholic, you're obliged under law to have a Catholic marriage or get a dispensation, or your marriage is not going to be valid. And to my mind, that's a really bad situation. I think that in this case, the cure was worse than the disease. And I think that the church should go back to a situation where it allows for people who have left the Catholic Church to get validly married, especially people who were, you know, baptized and not even raised in the Catholic Church. They ought to be able to get validly married. In fact, there are even questions you could ask about whether or not this technically meets the definition of a law and is binding. But, you know, we need to go into that here. I think that the current policy is not the best configured policy, and so I understand your concern about this situation, and I share your concern about this situation. Now, in terms of going forward, you know, you want to be an evangelist, Blake. You want to do what you can to bring people closer to Jesus, and that can include your friend and her Protestant husband. So I would say look for opportunities to encourage them to investigate the Catholic faith, to, you know, maybe invite them to Mass with you or something. And, you know, as they, if they do that and as they work their way down that path, this subject will come up and their situation can be dealt with. It's actually very simple to deal with. They just need to get their marriage convalidated. That's typically done through a private little ceremony. It's no big deal. I had one of those myself when my wife was alive, because she was Catholic and had married me outside the church. We got a convalidation. It was very easy to do. It was very low key. It was not a big deal. And so, you know, there are resolutions to this. Also recognize that because your friend was not well educated in Catholic teaching on these matters, if I'm remembering exactly what you said and not confusing it with the previous caller, you know, God knows that and takes that into account, and they can still, you know, love each other and have a productive marriage, and hopefully one day, you know, they'll be able to have a convalidation in the church.
Blake, thank you very, very much. I hope that was helpful to you. Onward I go, though, to try to get to everybody before we have to end. Deborah in Ontario, Canada is next. Deborah, watching on YouTube. Thanks for being here, Deborah. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hello, thank you for taking my question. And I actually just started listening to Mysterious World, and I'm very much enjoying it.
Oh, awesome.
Yes, you have a wide variety of knowledge. My question is, recently in my church, the new priest started using incense a lot. Mm-hmm. And okay. I'm very much allergic to it and extremely sensitive to it. Mm-hmm. Using it not once a week, it's like four times a week. So it's just, it's always in the church, that smell. Mm-hmm. And I can't even go into the entranceway. Now, I spoke to him. He said he can try a different scent. It won't matter for me because I have fragrance sensitivity to anything. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering... We have one Catholic church in town. I don't mm-hmm. have a car. Mm-hmm. And my option is to watch Mass online. Is mm-hmm. this something God understands, takes into account? Am I, because I know attending Mass is an obligation. Mm-hmm. So where does it lead me?
So I want to be encouraging here and suggest some options, and hopefully one way or another there can be a resolution to this. In terms of, you know, staying home and watching Mass on online or on television, that's something that God would understand for an adequate reason. And the question then becomes, do you have an adequate reason? Now, you don't want to be in a situation where you never receive the sacraments. You want to really make an effort to receive communion at least once a year during Easter time. You also want to be able to get to confession when you need that. That could be a little easier because you don't have to be in church for confession. You want to go to Mass on Sundays and the two holy days of obligation that they have in Canada. So you want to achieve a situation where all that's possible for you. But if there's an adequate reason, then God does understand that you can't make it to church. And so it's going to depend on the extent to which your pastor can modify what he's doing, either not using incense or using a different kind or using it less frequently, and what kind of allergy or sensitivity you have. If it's now, when we have sensitivities to things, sometimes they're psychological or partly psychological, and sometimes they're physical. And so, you know, one of the things you'll want to consider is how much of this is really physical in my case versus how much of it might be, I'm just so on edge because I know I have a physical sensitivity here and I'm worried about that, because it's very understandable if you know you have an allergy to something to be worried about how bad of an allergy it might be and what kind of situation you get in. So, you know, I would encourage you to, you know, think about, you know, just how bad is this physical reaction. And to the extent that the experience, it has a psychological component, I would say try to relax about that. You know, we all have fears of things. We all have anxieties. And when we identify those, we want to, you know, try to set those aside and relax and trust God and, you know, deal with what's left over. And so to the extent, you know, you have what remains as a physical issue to deal with, well, it might turn out that even if it's not as pleasant as it otherwise would be, it might be such that you could still go to Mass and it wouldn't be terribly horrible. On the other hand, if it is terribly horrible, maybe taking an antihistamine before you go to Mass would be something that would help and at least allow you to go to Mass on Sundays. Or if that doesn't work, maybe finding a friend who goes to church in a nearby town and could give you a lift would help. But if the best solution to the situation is really to just watch Mass online for an extended period, then, and your priest is just not willing to modify it, then God would understand that. One thing that I would investigate, if it looks like things are going to go in that direction, is I would say to the priest, you know, I know that this is something that you feel the use of it, this much incense is special and important, but it does interfere with my ability to attend church. And I think that we would be well advised to consult the bishop. And you know, ideally, you could consult the bishop together. So the priest gets to explain his side of things. You get to explain your side of things. If that's not practical, I would say that you can write a letter to the bishop. I would let the priest know that you're going to do that. And say, I think we should get a second opinion from the bishop about the best way to handle this, and then see what the bishop has to say. So I hope those are some options that are helpful ones that you can explore. And I encourage the listeners to pray that a successful resolution will be found.
Deborah, thanks very, very much. I hope that was helpful to you. Lots and lots of folks on the line, so I'll let you know we'll do at least an hour of open forum tomorrow with Tim Staples. So we weren't able to get to everybody, but we will be able to get to lots more tomorrow. So give us a call again tomorrow at 888-31-TRUTH. I forgot to read the ad again this hour, so I'll remind you that there's a big sale on over at shop.catholic.com. Use MyDeal22 to save an extra 20% off anything, even if it's already discounted. Get an extra 20% off everything over at shop.catholic.com by using MyDeal22. And when you check out, if your purchase goes over $75, anywhere in the United States, your shipping is free. Shop.catholic.com. I almost said tomorrow a new episode drops, but I forgot what day it is. On Friday, a new episode drops, and it's about the world's most famous cryptid. That's for Jimmy Akin's Mysterious
Other
World.
Other than Bigfoot.
Oh, yeah, that's true, huh? Bigfoot, yeah. The world's second most famous cryptid, the Loch Ness Monster. What happened in 1930? I'm going to find out on Friday. I don't actually know. Jimmy didn't tell me. On 1934, what happened that made this whole Loch Ness Monster thing happen? Check it out on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Jimmy will be back with us Thursday. We'll do some a Memorex version of the show for the Feast of the Immaculate Conception. Jimmy, thank you very much for doing these 2 hours with us. A lot of fun.
My pleasure, Cy Kellett.
All right, we'll see you tomorrow, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.